The Towering Inferno is dedicated to the firefighters of the world, who give their lives so that others can live. And we at Home Movie Club would like to echo that dedication, and to add our own to the 71 souls who lost their lives in the Grenfell Tower fire of June 2017.
That Podcast Thing presents Home Movie Club, originally recorded December 2017. Episode 19, Worst Party Ever.
Hello and welcome to Home Movie Club, the podcast in which we take an irreverent and sometimes, let's face it, an irrelevant look at the top grossing movies of the last 80 odd years. This time round, we have been watching 1974's Towering Inferno. As always, I am delighted to say that I am joined by Joe Carter.
Hello!
Daisy Swaffer.
Hi!
And as always, my darling wife, Sammy Kelsch.
Hello!
So yes, 1974's Towering Inferno.
Oh boy.
Everything's on fire!
It's, I think, generally, the 70s are seen as the time of the disaster movie, kind of kickstarted by 1970s Airport, which we have already watched on this podcast, and kind of peaking in the 75s with sort of this and Airport 75, and there was Poseidon Adventure at 72 or 73, I think it was.
72, then we'll be covering that one. Can I kick in straight here with a fun fact?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So there was two novels that were about Towering Infernos, basically called The Tower and The Glass Inferno, and two separate movie studios had optioned these two books. So they were both planning on doing a skyscraper on fire movie the following year. Yeah, so they both kind of got wind of the fact that each other was going to be doing this and went, this might not be such a good idea to compete with each other with really quite similar films. So they combined forces. They made it together.
Oh, yeah. I like that result.
Which so I, nice. I think goes honestly, some way as to why we've got such an all-star cast with this. And they divvied up the box office takings from it as well. One of the studios got the US box office and the other one got the rest of the world.
Mm. Yeah, I did notice at the start that it said it was based on two separate books, so
and that's why. And so it's both the endings from both of the books feature as the ending for this film. Yeah, it's interesting.
Right. That's interesting because it doesn't feel like a pair of disjointed narratives mapped together. It just
I think
like
it's why we jump around so many characters early on, because they're trying to get key characters from both of these books so that it is properly using both of the books. Mm. But it feels a bit disjointed early on as a result. Yeah. And I think
some
that's
of the
why.
Characters don't even seem to be, you know, they're in it very briefly. And then not in it any longer, not to give any spoilers away. So yes, 1974, Towering Inferno, and then obviously we work up till about the sort of the end of the 70s when the genre sort of loses steam. There's a sequel to the Poseidon Adventure, apparently, which I don't quite see how that works.
yeah,
anything could be sequelized if you are avaricious enough, I think.
Yeah, and that did not very well at the box office, and so the genre sort of slowly died. Although, ironically, it then had a little bit of a kickback up with the release in 1980 of Airplane.
I love this.
Which obviously is more of a comedy than a disaster movie, but has the same sort of standard tropes.
And it's a classic, and I'm still disappointed it's not on the list.
Joe and I watched it recently, and I've got to say, my memory of it was better than the rewatching of it now.
Oh,
sorry.
Not 100% surprised by that. And obviously, we did have a return to the disaster movie genre, because you have things like Titanic, which again, we've already watched, and things like Independence Day that are the sort of following the same tropes of some big disaster and lots of names that you don't know whether or not they're going to survive to the end of the film or not.
Mm.
And in many cases, they don't.
Spoilers.
But yeah, so this is 1974 and we're looking at The Towering Inferno.
Can I just say something? Even if I didn't know that it was 1974, the furniture in that first shot was just so 70s. It was unbelievable.
The decor in this was iconic.
Mm. Yeah. I made a note in my notes, and obviously this is a little bit of a spoiler, but not really. that when everything starts burning, the fumes given off by that 1970s furniture must have been horrific.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Ugh. I just imagine it smelling like my grandma's perfume, licorice all sorts, and like that really bright yellow mustard.
Ugh, yes. So let's get some...
That's a really random combination. But yeah, it's that mustard yellow and...
like in my mind.
Burnt orange and sort of weird muted patterns. I swear, like, it could have come out of my mom's living room. We did actually go watch a play that was set in the 70s. And quite literally, mum was like, oh, we still have that lamp. We had that sofa. We had that table.
Yeah, again, living through the 70s, there was quite a lot in there. It was, you know, a lot of it was not the sort of thing my parents would have, but colour schemes and that definitely, definitely rang bells.
It evokes a certain visual nostalgia, I think, quite well.
Brown and orange, I think, were the themes there.
Mm. So harvest.
And flowers. Yeah. Flowers as well.
Yeah.
So flower harvest, patterns. Very meadow.
Let's get some opening thoughts then. Joe, do you want to give us your opening thoughts?
Well, I hadn't seen this before, and I wasn't quite sure going into it what really to expect. Certainly didn't expect to see Steve McQueen in the opening credits. I thought that was quite cool, but then I realised I don't actually know what he looks like, so I may have just gone onto IMDb to find out which one was Steve McQueen. Not the one I thought he was.
Listeners, he was Fireman Man.
He was the Fireman Man that did the thing at the end, but who was the architect guy? Because
Paul Newman.
That was Paul Newman.
That was Paul Newman. Okay, well, I thought he was Steve McQueen. But either which way, the both of them were great.
And, yeah, I generally get those two mixed up as well, although as Sammy did point out this morning, we have watched Butch Cassidy, which was also Paul Newman, so, you know.
Oh, that's why he looked so familiar. Oh, my God.
Can I jump in with a fun fact there, then?
Yes. Go on.
Steve McQueen was originally going to star alongside Paul Newman in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And it was during that negotiation that they originally came up with this thing where they both wanted to have top billing. So the top left is where the top name goes. So in order to have them both have top billing, they have Steve McQueen in the top left and then Paul Newman is top right, but higher up. So if you read it top to bottom, Paul Newman is top. And if you read it left to right, Steve McQueen is top. And so obviously Steve McQueen pulled out of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, but they used what they had been working on for that equal billing scenario for this movie.
I like it.
Daisy, your opening thoughts, and we know you're a fan of the disaster movie genre, so...
Yep, this is how I like my disaster movies. Mortal peril the whole way through. Awful, awful, disastrous, everything goes wrong, people die constantly. I loved it.
You are so... strange.
I am strange.
And Sammy, your opening thoughts, please.
Well, I'll be honest with you. There are certain stages of my life where mere existence feels like a disaster movie. And as such, it's not my favorite genre. So it was a well-done movie, but not something I'd choose to watch on, like, a relaxing Saturday night.
It's okay. We watched it on a Friday night, so.
Also not relaxing.
No, I mean, I enjoyed it, but it wasn't... Well, I thought it was a good film, but I'm not sure I'd say I enjoyed it. It was definitely not
odd.
A bad film, but I don't know if it was the sort of thing I'd want to rush and watch again.
Yeah.
Unlike Airport, which I potentially could watch again, because it was less constant mortal peril. It was more sort of, I think, what do we call it, marital disaster as opposed to natural disaster.
Yeah, whereas for me, that it didn't have enough disaster in it, and I love this because it is just so awful for everyone involved.
So, film opens with a scenic view of a helicopter flying over the bay in San Francisco, which led me to my first note in my things was, are you allowed to fly a helicopter that low in an urban area? But I suspect it was the times,
it
wasn't it?
It was the 70s. So, I think you can say a lot of things that you see in like old movies now, just it was the 70s.
Yeah, a lot of things that you see in old movies would not happen these days.
No, we'll get to that later as well.
Oh, anytime anyone smokes in like, you know, sort of... anywhere apart from, you know, sort of... Anytime someone
designated
smokes...
Designated smoking area.
Just generally, you know...
Can we just make a note over those opening helicopter ride that they did put a dedication up for dedicated to firefighters across
yeah,
the world?
Yeah, I saw that.
And I really liked that they made that dedication
really pretty,
at the
really
start
beautiful.
Of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially because, you know, obviously things don't go great for the firefighters in this film. No. And it was really nice to give that kind of nod to them all. Mm. Including yes, my brother, who is a firefighter, so I liked that.
Hey.
Indeed. The helicopter's occupant, Doug Roberts, played by Paul Newman, is a chief architect for Duncan Enterprises, an architectural firm specialising in skyscrapers. The helicopter rises up and lands on the roof of the tallest building in the San Francisco skyline.
The tallest tower.
Did they say in this, I can't remember, that it was the tallest tower in the
world?
They
did, yeah,
point.
They said tallest in the world.
Wow.
Also, I think they need to find a new speciality.
Yeah, I mean, this tower obviously doesn't exist in the real world, but...
Well, I don't think they need a new speciality. They just need to make it per the design instead of cutting lots of corners.
Well, they need to design it better for being able to fight fires, but...
Yeah, well, this is Duncan Enterprises' greatest project. It is called the Glass Tower.
Oh.
Which is a brand new 550-meter high skyscraper.
Which they named it the Glass Tower because that, again, was an amalgamation of the two books, The Glass Inferno and The Tower. And I thought that was quite nice to name it in that way.
So, yes, it's a very tall 550 meters, which I think is in the film, because obviously this is an American film, they said it was 1,800 feet.
It was like 200-odd stories, wasn't it? No, 120 stories.
About 138 stories, I think. The party was on the 135th, and I think there was three floors above that.
Right, yeah. Okay, cool.
Which actually nowadays is not very high at all, but obviously this was the 1970s and it was...
Yeah,
that's still pretty high to me.
Yeah, that is still pretty high. That's a lot of floors.
How many floors are in the Shard? Does anyone know?
Oh, somebody worked there briefly, sweetheart.
I can't remember. We weren't very high up. I think we were like on the 17th floor or something, so... There's not that many because the top half of the Shard is all residential and no one lives there, so...
Is it residential? Much like the Glass Tower in the movie, where we get these funny little chopped and changed little scenes. And so one entire scene was just overhearing someone saying, oh, yes, the business offices are floors 1 to 80 and then 81 and above are residential. And then different scene.
it's just a little bit like that crowbarred in. Yeah. So, yes, this is the opening night and the dedication ceremony for the tower. And guests of the celebration include Mayor Robert Ramsey, played by Jack Collins, who gets quite high billing in the film, so I assume was famous at the time.
Mm.
And Senator Gary Parker, who was played by Robert Vaughn.
Yay!
Best known for Man from U.N.C.L.E., I'm going to say?
Yes.
Man from U.N.C.L.E. So yes, apparently the senator being there is a big deal because Jim Duncan, who is the company's president, played by William Holden, again a man fairly high up in the billing, so I assume famous at the time.
He was on a decline of his fame, so he was originally actually going to be the top billed actor. Just a little fun fact for you there.
Okay, because I've never heard of him, so I don't know what else he's been in. But
stuff earlier than this.
Yes,
because he was old.
He hadn't the last time he'd starred in anything. I think was 1969, and so that's why really his fame was declining, and he didn't get the top billing anymore.
But yeah, so he's wooing the senator because the senator is trying to get the senator to support the Urban Renewal Act, or rather the Urban Renewal Effort, which will allow the company to build a lot more skyscrapers. So obviously, it's in it for the money.
Mm-hmm.
So Roberts flies in, Paul Newman's character, and lands on the helipad at the top of the tower, goes down to his office, and finds his fiancée waiting for him. This is magazine editor Susan Franklin, played by Faye Dunaway.
Yay!
A name I had actually heard of.
Yeah, another one in the all-star cast.
She's lovely. Yep.
So after the IMDb article has them as after the two renew their romantic acquaintances.
That is some excellent wording.
They
wow.
went through to a back room where she had a bed set up and he brought $140 worth of lingerie for her. So
and I put in brackets, boingy boingy.
Boingy boingy. And I think that sums it up, yeah.
Yep.
So after this, she reveals that she has received a long-sought promotion, but obviously this would throw a wrench in their plans to move to the countryside and have a family. So they're discussing this and trying to decide what to do when they get a phone call.
There's absolutely no reason for us to care about this at this point. Like, this never actually becomes relevant in the rest of the film. And at this point, we don't know the characters to care. So this just feels like a waste of our time finding out these details about their lives.
I agree.
Supposed to make you care.
I guess the
more
idea is to make you invested in the characters by giving you a bit of a, you know, sort of glimpse into what else is going on in their lives.
I think if they had fewer characters, then I probably would. But with the small amount of time that we had, then these kind of details were just like, oh, well, that was just a waste. It's a it's over 2.5 hours long. This film, it could have lost some of these bits.
So yes, they're interrupted by a call from the tower's utility room. Apparently, during a routine check of the building's generators, there is a power surge that blows out a circuit breaker in the control room. So lots of smoke, but no real fire. However, unbeknownst to anyone, the surge also blows out another circuit breaker, this time in one of the 81st floor storage closets, that sends a live wire flopping around onto some shop rags that conveniently catch fire.
Yeah, that was poor storage.
There was paint thinner and all
sorts.
There was the
explosive
cupboard
and everything in there. That was not going to pass H&S.
Yeah, redecorating obviously left some stuff, but
I mean, on the bright side, this is 12 minutes in and we've already got the fire started.
Yeah, so I was really
this movie
happy about this.
Not,
it's like, yeah, already.
Not bloody mutiny.
We've got the fire. Yeah, this isn't like, okay, we're going to wait the whole film and finally have a towering inferno. This is, oh my God, there's already a fire and they haven't realised. This is straight away, I'm on the edge of my seat. Great, this is great. Sorry.
The control room / security room was really weird. Because it felt like they should have detected that there was a fire because there were things going off. But then they looked on cameras and then it wasn't. And it was just like, what?
I think it's because it happened in two places at once. And so they thought they were getting a false alarm.
Yeah, they saw that it was happening in the control, in the utility room, but saw that that was in hand and didn't go any further. But one thing we did see, and it's mentioned slightly later on, is that none of the, or a lot of the safety systems have yet to be installed, and this tower really isn't ready for its grand opening.
It does actually, they do actually say that.
Yeah.
That is specifically said at one point, I think.
Yeah, I think Paul Newman was a bit vocal about that, wasn't he? Like, really? Mm. We haven't got, this isn't, no, I'm the architect, my name is on this, what are you doing?
Yeah. So, Paul Newman's character, Roberts, consults with his assistant, William Giddings, who is apparently Norman Burton, but I've never heard of him, and he doesn't seem to be in much else, so...
As long as it's not Norman Bates.
No, and he also had his name several sheets down in the ones where there was multiple, so obviously he's not quite as famous.
A venerable supporting actor, though. Well done, Norman.
And the two of them confront Jim Duncan, who's the head of Duncan Enterprises, about the wiring. Duncan's chief engineer is his son-in-law, Roger Simmons, played by Richard Chamberlain.
Boo.
A really lovely man.
Yeah, we don't like him.
Not you, Richard. I'm sure you're a nice man, but your character was pants.
Yeah.
Boo. I may have cheered.
To all three men's annoyance, Simmons cannot be reached by phone.
Of course.
They did really clearly telegraph to us that Roger's not a nice guy. In a slightly panto-esque way, really. I think that's why I was immediately going boo.
Yeah, literally.
But that's
literally.
I like a clear-cut villain.
Like this character.
Yeah. It's nice to have a clear-cut villain in a disaster movie.
Flashing on the screen, you do not want to like this man.
Yeah.
So while Giddings is working with the building's chief security officer, Harry Jernigan, who is played by O.J. Simpson. Yes, that O.J. Simpson.
What?
On the electrical systems.
Was that, that was the guy that, spoilers, saved the cat?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Right, that was O.J.
Yeah.
That was O.J. Simpson. That
shows how much attention I pay to actually
his before he allegedly murdered his wife. So
Many years
it was
before.
Fine. He was still at the top of his game, I think, at this point in his football
I didn't realise
career.
He was an actor. I thought he was a politician for some reason.
He started off as a sports person. He was an American footballer and then went on to be actor.
Oh.
So, yes, Giddings is working with Jerrigan on the electrical systems. Doug Roberts goes off and actually tracks down Roger Simmons and his wife in their home. And confront Simmons about the wiring. And in my notes, I wrote Simmons, a thoroughly unpleasant man.
Yeah.
And he was. I mean, he insists that the wiring's up to city safety codes, although
That's Doug not what said. Was asked, though. It was
yeah,
like
the codes
did you
are
follow...
not sufficient yeah. for a 1,800 foot skyscraper.
Yeah, the codes.
Did
are
you
not
follow
meant
my
for
instructions?
Like
they're up to code. Did you follow my instructions? They're up to code. It's not what I asked.
Yeah. So yeah, Simmons nevertheless dismisses Doug, who sort of that agitates Patty, as she is the daughter of the owner of the business and obviously doesn't want to antagonize him.
Hang on, doesn't want to antagonize whom? Her dad?
Doesn't want to antagonize her dad.
I gotta say, in my notes where we learnt about the electrics, I put that Roger cheaped out on the electrics, and it's a bit like cheaping out on the cladding of a high rise.
Yeah.
And that felt like really that. I think that was the moment for me in this that it felt a lot more closer to home from Grenfell.
Yeah.
Mm. Where it was like, yeah, yeah, corners were cut, and what happens yeah. when you cut corners is disaster happens, and it might not be immediate like it is in the Towering Inferno, but it is ultimately because corners are cut. Mm. And that's definitely yeah. a lesson you can take away from this film, is don't cut corners.
Yeah, because, yeah. I mean, it wasn't just him that cut corners as well.
Yeah, the building
materials. From what it sounded like later on,
well.
Like building
yeah,
materials
I mean, one could quite
and
easily
fire
argue
doors
that the-
and-
Yeah, the fault was actually with Duncan.
Yeah, for insisting on the cost savings. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, but you know what the best line was? I know it was near the end of it, but when Paul Newman, whose character's name I've forgotten, was talking to Duncan and said, "Where were you when this was happening? Where was I? Because I'm responsible for this too." I thought that was the best line. He didn't yeah. abdicate responsibility, you know, even though he. Because he should have followed up on it, but he didn't directly have anything to do with it, but he still took yeah. that responsibility. I thought that was really beautiful, because so many people will just go, "Oh, well, it was your fault. You should have done that." But it's like, no, it's your fault, but it's also really my fault. I should have made sure that everything was up to spec before.
Yeah.
So I thought,
so despite
yeah,
the
was,
wiring issues yeah. and the fact that some of the safety systems have yet to be fully installed, nothing go wrong there, obviously. Dedication ceremony goes on as scheduled, and the entire building is lit up for the party in the promenade room on the 135th floor.
The whole building is lit
slightly.
Up. The whole building is
yeah,
lit
the,
up.
The power
and we just learned about the electrics being cheaped out on. The whole building is lit up. Awooga, awooga, alarm bells.
I mean, this was always sort of a big deal. But on the other hand, they also had lots of people in the building already. So there must have been quite a lot of this lighting already turned on. I mean, in the scene, it literally is like lighting up the bat signal. Everything suddenly just comes on. Mm. But does that mean for the last hour and a half, these people were sitting in the dark because they weren't allowed to turn their lights off? I didn't get that slightly.
Well, it would have been less dramatic if there'd have been the odd window.
It would indeed have been less dramatic, yes. So Doug and Will are missing the party as they examine more wiring and find it to be even worse shape than they originally thought. Wrong gauge wiring, it meant that it was running far too hot.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, he specifically then rang down to the
yep,
generator.
So he rings
room,
down
yeah.
and tells them to shut off the power overload. So anything that's not being used for the party gets turned off.
Mm.
And then he says he and Will head to the 81st floor to check on the relay systems. However, at that point, security cameras also detect smoke from that floor's storage closet. And this is the floor where we saw the fire take hold initially. And Harry Jennigan has the fire department called. So, you know, even at this point, we've actually got the fire department on the way.
Yeah, I mean, at this point in the film, I've written in my notes, fire, lots of fire, because already we have got a significant amount of fire.
Well, I mean, it's only one room full.
Yeah.
I mean, considering there are lots of
raging in that room.
Yeah.
So Jennigan proceeds to 81, but before he arrives, Doug, Will and other executives also spot the smoke seeping out from under the storage closet door. But when one of the security guards tries to open the door, the fire erupts into the hallway, engulfing Will Geddings.
Yeah, because
first
what
body.
Idiot opens a door what smoke is coming out of? Seriously!
Yeah, we know this now, but then we've all seen Backdraft. So.
Yeah,
I haven't seen Backdraft.
Seen Backdraft. I'm just, you know,
okay,
I
we've
have
all learned
sense.
About Backdraft then, and they
haven't. We've all had, yeah, we've all had fire safety training, which possibly they haven't. So yes, they open the door and the fire just erupts into the hallway, engulfing Will Geddings. Doug and the others smother Geddings in drapes while one man grabs a fire hose and begins spraying the flaming storage closet. Obviously, this is why Will Geddings and the actor who played him were not that high up on the list, because that's pretty much all we see of him.
Yep.
So
it's kind of hard to come back from that.
I didn't even know who it was that got set on fire, to be perfectly honest at this point.
Death count plus one.
I do have a death count for the whole film.
Yeah. So Jernigan arrives and orders Doug to call an ambulance and also to call Jim Duncan and evacuate the promenade room while he
helps get Geddings
to the ground floor.
Oh my god.
So yes, as you can tell from Joe's slight exasperation, what happens is Doug calls Duncan, but Duncan insists the fire won't spread.
It's 50 floors down, it can't touch us here.
Yeah, and tells Duncan to put on his bow tie and attend the ceremony.
Oh my god, seriously, so much of this could have been avoided.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
The fire department are on their way at this point, though, aren't they? So.
Well, at this point, the fire department arrives in force with Battalion Chief Mike O'Halloran. Yay.
There we go, Steve McQueen. And he goes, why on earth do they insist on building these things? Because they know we can't reliably, you know, put out a fire past the seventh floor. And I'm thinking, God, there's like 130 odd of these floors.
Lord.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Interestingly, in the terms of the Steve McQueen, Paul Newman rivalry, they have exactly the same number of lines in the film.
Oh my God!
Yep, on purpose. Which means, Steve McQueen's fire chief role. He was originally going to be the architect, but he wanted to be the fire chief instead. So they had to make the fire chief role bigger to make it so he had an equal number of lines as Paul Newman. And because the fire chief doesn't come in until this point in the film, Paul Newman's had a big chunk of his lines already. Which means that in the period of time that the two of them are in the film, it means Steve McQueen's character is more dominant because he's got more lines than when the two of them are doing lines. Interesting. Yeah.
So despite the fact that the fire chief doesn't like architects, they start to work together and set up a forward command in Roberts' office, which is two floors below the fire. Yeah. O'Halloran quickly goes to the promenade room, gets most of his fire equipment off, not to panic people, and confronts Jim Duncan to evacuate the area. Duncan resists this, but it is pointed out that as chief fire person, he basically pulls rank on anybody, including the mayor who is at the ceremony.
Yes. It's like, in case of fire, I'm in charge.
Yeah, so Duncan reluctantly agrees, and they start moving people down.
Down
via the main elevators, which is
In case of fire, do not use elevator or lift or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah,
obviously that wasn't
suddenly
a
gas line
then.
Ruptures and explodes, detonating more fires around the building and reaching the main elevator banks.
Yeah, and doesn't it explode and kill a few firemen as well?
Oh, no.
Yeah,
crowd of partiers evacuating via the elevator find the elevator stopping and opening on the fire floor.
Well, that's what they told them not to use that elevator, because they said that the fire might trigger the elevator to stop there, so you must not use that elevator. And then the elevator doors dinged open and they all piled in. So they all died because they didn't listen to instructions during a fire.
Because they were idiots.
So they went down and the blaze engulfed them. Although for some reason I didn't understand this bit, the elevator goes back up to the promenade room. And a soul-burning man sort of flails out the elevator and dies on the promenade room floor.
Yeah, that's disturbing. That is so disturbing.
I mean, it was obviously enough to shock the people in... It was done to shock the people in the room to make it more... to give it more urgency. Yeah. But I do not see why the elevator went back up to that floor.
Because it has some they'd pressed kind the button. Of setting.
No. Because when the elevator doors closed, the owner, pressed the button to bring the elevator up. So obviously...
Yes, he did, didn't he? Well spotted. I'd missed that one entirely. Yeah.
I was mostly paying attention.
Very savvy, Joe. Well done.
Evacuating the party guests, they decide to use a scenic elevator, which is a glass elevator that runs down the side of the outside of the building. This is not going to be a quick job, though. So Senator Parker speaks to Duncan and says that it would be possibly not a bad idea for those with stout hearts and trim waistlines to use the stairs. However, they try the first emergency exit, but immediately find it full of smoke when they open the door.
Good job there's more than one stairwell, then, isn't there?
Yeah, they then try the other door, but the door appears to be stuck.
Oh, no!
Oh, my God, yeah, that door is stuck, isn't it?
They enlist the aid of Carlos, who is the head bartender, but the three men are unable to find a way to open the fire door.
And we will find out later why that is.
To me, this scene looks like they're just throwing the weight at the door, and it feels like it's probably a pull door.
Yeah.
That's literally what that scene, I know it probably wasn't, but it looked just looked like that they were trying desperately to open this door by trying to kick it in and it would actually just
no, it's got one of those safety push bar things on it that you have on fire doors.
Mm.
One of the partygoers, the painter Lizalette Muller, who is played by Jennifer Jones in apparently her final role, who is there being entertained by shady businessman Harley Claiborne, played by an elderly Fred Astaire.
Shady businessman.
Oh my god, that guy is... He's both adorable and sinister at the same time.
He got nominated... I think nominated didn't win an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for this film, which I don't think was deserved.
No, he was in it for, what, like 10 minutes?
But it's Fred Astaire and he probably hadn't been... it's one of those where they, if they haven't been... nominated for anything else, they kind of the Academy goes, we probably should.
Yeah, he'd never been nominated for an Academy Award before, so yeah, I think that was. Oh well, we better give you one now. You've been in a film
a nice
again,
job,
okay?
But you know, it was yeah.
Yeah, so she doesn't evacuate the building. Instead, rushes to the 87th floor, where a deaf woman, Mrs. Albright, lives with her two children, who are students of Ms. Muller's as paint students. I don't know how. I guess they just the children are quite young. They're what. 6 and 4 or something.
They are small.
5 and 7. So they're not exactly what you call serious artists. But however, the security cameras on CCTV spot Muller and security chief Jernigan and Doug rush to the 87th floor to rescue the Albrights because they realise what's happening because obviously the security chief knows that the lady is deaf.
Yes. Yes. So
I mean, the lady's deaf. The elder boy seemed to be seen every time with
headphones.
A very 70s set of
those
headphone radios.
Were incredible.
It felt like her being deaf was going to have a bigger impact on the story.
Yeah, I think it just was that she hadn't evacuated because she hadn't heard any of the alarms because she was deaf.
Yeah,
yeah, but the kids should have...
Yeah, I mean, even if the eldest boy had his headset and couldn't hear anything... The girl should have alerted them. And, you know, at this point, there's quite a lot of smoke as well, so...
Mm. Yeah, I have to admit that I did spend part of that bit of the film being very confused because I knew that they'd gone to rescue a deaf lady, but because I wasn't paying 100% attention to which one was the deaf lady, when there were two kids, the lady and the architect guy, I was like, why is he speaking to her instructions? Yeah. She's deaf, she can't hear.
I thought exactly the same thing because they looked alike and so I thought that was the deaf lady.
Yeah, and you only see the deaf Mrs. Albright for a very short period. Yeah.
So what happens to her then?
She is rescued by the security guard. She's rescued by Jennigan, who is O.J. Simpson.
She's unconscious, so she's carried out, but I thought she must have just like regained consciousness. But obviously
no, apparently she's carried out and down, but then the fire cuts off Doug, her two children, and Lizalette Muller, which is why you then get that four making their way down a separate way.
Right. That makes more sense now because I'm all I'm thinking is that's Mrs. Albright. Because I swear the kids call her Mrs. Albright as well. And I'm like, why are you giving her instructions? She can't hear you.
Yeah, I suddenly thought that got was better really... hearing, but no,
yeah,
it wasn't.
I feel like the fact that she was deaf and that whole kind of part of it, I think probably played a bigger role in the book, whichever one of the two books it came from. But because they just kind of put this in the way that they had with the amalgamation of these two books, then it just seemed a bit odd as a result. Because as you say, it didn't seem to make much sense.
In this, it does seem to be an excuse to get the two kids sort of into a certain area of danger. So when a gas line explodes on the stairway, Doug, Ms. Muller and the children realise they have only one option, that is to trek and climb up the 47 floors to the promenade room. They manage to survive another explosion and sort of climb down pipeways and just
that
generally...
is a quite good scene with the whole... exploding staircase and then
the dangling
and then getting the kids and that was really quite good. I was expecting
nobody died at that bit. I was just what, you're depriving me of my body count, what is wrong with you?
I mean,
kill
we
a kid
were...
at this point.
Daisy, I'm slightly worried about you.
It's a disaster.
I was kind of cool with them not dying.
Yeah, we were watching it and said there's no way they're going to kill the two kids or the cat we saw earlier.
Oh, I wanted one of the kids to plummet down the shaft and you wouldn't see them actually die. You'd just see that they'd fallen and obviously it was going to be that they were dead. But no, they all made it. Very disappointing.
I don't think they'd have been allowed to do that, to be honest.
No.
Well, it should have been the lady that went then.
Yep. So we've got the kids, Mrs. Mueller and Paul Newman's character, make it to the top floor, but then they find the reason the door is stuck and the reason no one could get through it before is because there's construction cement left on the floor that is blocking the door.
Like an overturned wheelbarrow and just loads of cement. Yeah. Like, that was really, like, that gives you a level of how shoddily this building
just
has been finished.
Shockingly poorly put together, really.
Yeah.
However, I mean, at this point, the people in the promenade room have already rang down to say that the door is blocked. So we get a scene where two firemen make their way up to the 135th floor. Mm. And once they get there, they meet up with Doug and the kids and Ms. Mueller and actually blow the door out with C4 explosive. However, by this point, the stairway below them has already been consumed by fire. It means that they can't get out that way anyway.
Mm.
So another escape route foiled.
Mm.
But when they get up there, one of the firemen, they've gone up there knowing that it's blocked. So the firemen have arrived with a pickaxe and the dude taps the handle of the pickaxe against the cement and says there's no shifting that. And I'm like, use the other end!
I didn't realise he had a pickaxe. I don't know what I thought
it was a pickaxe. I'm just like, the other end is designed for this purpose. You brought it up specifically for this. Do you want to at least have a go with it before declaring
the thing
is, no moving
you, it? You wouldn't have a go at the concrete. You'd always have a go at the door because wood's less... You know.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, really. Yeah.
But no. We're not going to use the pickaxe. We're going to blow it up in a building that's on fire.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's C4. It's specific explosive for that type,
and that's priming us.
It's also going to be quicker and easier
later on. So yeah.
Yeah. So they go in, and the room is the fire escape is fully blocked, and they're told everybody in the room is told not to go down that way. But Simmons, being the wonderful person, tries it anyway. And collapses in the flames. And everybody goes, yes, he's dead. But unfortunately not, because he manages to get back up into the promenade room.
Yeah. It's like the firemen say, there's no way down, there's no staircase. And he's like, I do not believe you professionals. You clearly don't know what you're doing. He's like a walking
white privilege.
And
tries to persuade his wife to go down with him.
I was so happy that he was going to die, and then he didn't.
Yeah.
No, don't worry.
Spoilers.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Come on, this whole podcast is a spoiler.
Yeah, spoilers for The Towering Inferno. If you're listening to this podcast, you might want to watch
you
it.
Should probably
I think a film of 1974, the spoiler warnings have kind of passed.
What is the statute of limitations on spoilers? Because I've seen posts tagged, you know, like Star Wars spoilers for like the prequels. And I'm thinking if at this stage you haven't seen those yet, you can't be surprised if you get spoiled.
Mm. No. So the power's failing, the generators are dying, and there's no backups. So they realise the best way to evacuate the promenade room now is using a naval helicopter to land on the rooftop. So they send a helicopter in. However, as it's landing, several panicked partygoers...
Well, they know that it's going to be only a few people at a time, so I think they dealt with that really fairly. They went women and children first and do a random draw for numbers for what order everyone is going to go in. And they were actually like calm and collected and all did that. And I was quite impressed with that kind of organization and discipline that they all had.
Mm.
Yeah. But when the helicopter comes in to land, several of the party goers panic, sort of rush at the helicopter, but obviously this forces the helicopter to swerve out of the way, and then it crashes into the roof, exploding and killing the two pilots.
Because I thought it was the headwinds that they couldn't.
They were talking about high winds being a problem, certainly.
And then I hadn't realised. I knew people had rushed forward. I hadn't realised that had caused the helicopter to swerve. I just saw them rush forward and then the helicopter crash.
No, and thought it was because the helicopter obviously was moving away from the people, because you don't want to chop people up with rotor blades. and it crashes and the two pilots killed.
Yeah.
Two more for the death
kill. And during all this as well, we're getting Fred Astaire trying to seduce that woman and telling him that he's from Monte Carlo, but you know, women are just throwing themselves at me there and it's a bit boring, so I thought I'd come here. Like, what?
Yeah.
What?
It's blatantly obvious that he's talking rubbish, but yeah. So they realise the only hope is now is set up a breeches boy from a building a block away and use that sort of a rope and pulley system to get people out of the room. Now, breeches boys are something sort of that is a lifeguard thing as well, so I've seen that used before. However, while they're setting this up, and again breaking windows with the barest tap of an axe, Doug manages to bypass the safety systems on the observation elevator and manages to activate a gravity brake so that 12 people, which is the woman who were supposed to be carried out in the helicopter and the two children.
And a firefighter and one extra because there was...
Plus a firefighter who knows what he's doing and also Ms. Muller.
Who's the lady that saved the children.
Because she saved the children. Can get out and get down to the ground even though there will be no power to return the elevator to the promenade room.
Hmm.
However, because this is a disaster movie, this goes horribly wrong.
It's all that, because it's doing it on the gravity brake, it's so painstakingly slowly descending. And we keep getting these amazing external shots of the building. If I could say how the external shots were done. They used miniatures, as you'd expect, but also matte paintings.
Wow.
Yes. And they used some exterior shots of the Bank of America building as well. And interior shots were the Hyatt Regency. I believe that elevator, that glass elevator on the outside, is the Hyatt Regency's elevator, and it gets used in lots of different films. This whole kind of combination of different things, but matte paintings was like, really? then you see the external shot and this lift crawling down really slowly, and you keep, throughout this, we've kept cutting to these external shots where you get these big kabooms. Oh my god, there's more flames coming out of another floor. We never really understand why it's so many different, completely different floors across the building, but who cares? Oh my god, it's so dramatic and it's so amazing, and this lift is going so slowly.
Yep, so an explosion goes off and tears the elevator off its track, and the jolt of that throws Lisolette Muller out through the side of the elevator, through the glass, again, just plain glass by the
very
look of it.
Very easily broken glass,
because she seemed really nice.
Yep, and
yeah,
down,
really
unfortunately,
sad.
To her death below.
I was sad about that, because she seemed nice.
Oh, yeah, she was like, oh, I totally know you're a con man, so you don't need to bother, because I like you anyway. That was her, wasn't it?
Yeah, was her.
So the worst thing with that was that it was she'd been given quite a lot of screen time at this point, obviously just saving the kids and other things. But when she died, I think we spent a good 5 minutes trying to work out whether it was her or not.
Mm. Oh no,
because
I knew it was her.
I didn't.
That's the only time we actually knew who died.
I assumed it was her, but I wasn't 100% sure.
Yeah,
and it was like,
I didn't know.
Yeah, so it was her, unfortunately. So she is a no more.
Bye bye.
Another one for the death count.
So. The breeches boy is set up between the promenade room and the tower on the other side of the block.
Mm-hmm.
And they start evacuating the remaining women from the tower.
Yes. That looks rather terrifying, but they do
absolutely
pretty well.
Terrifying,
oh, God,
yes.
That metal chair with just like a little seatbelt strapping them on. And
yep,
it's
and
so
they
slow,
basically...
one at a time, and so slow.
Yeah.
Well, they've got to be careful.
Yeah, I know, but it's like there's a lot of people in that room, and that is that's going to take a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But they think they have the time at that point.
Yeah, and that will become a thing later on, but they are just progressing to remove people from the tower in this breeches boy system, sort of in the order they had on their numbers on their... picked up pieces of paper.
Yeah.
And at this point, it's still fairly orderly.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the women are not particularly pleased about the thought of hanging from a bit of rope across a chasm several hundred metres up, but that's understandable.
They all do it, even when they're absolutely terrified about it. They do it because they understand what the alternative is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Considering they're terrified, they don't at least portray them as hysterical.
Yeah.
Which is really appreciated. Mm. It doesn't... I mean, okay, it's the 70s and it you know...
I would be hysterical.
Yeah. But, I mean, the movie... Yeah, in like, the movie, the women, you know, they're pretty damn plucky, I think is a good word. I would be terrified. I could not have gotten that thing. I would have rather died in the fire, I think.
Al Halloran leads... the fire chief Al Halloran leads an effort to rescue those trapped in the observation elevator. So he uses a naval rescue helicopter to... the plan is to get a cable onto the elevator, cut it from its tracks, and then lower it to the ground with the survivors inside the elevator.
I am actually surprised that this works.
The firefighter inside the elevator climbs out and assists O'Halloran with hooking up the cables and cutting the elevator's cables. But in doing so, he's jolted off the elevator and is left hanging from the side, his fall stopped by O'Halloran grabbing his arms as he fell.
Well,
and
I
was very ready to add that one to the death count.
No, but wait!
Yeah.
It somehow manages, the helicopter somehow manages to lower them enough that when Steve McQueen finally can't hold on any longer, or the guy can't hold on to Steve any longer, he falls. But oh wait, it's like, I don't know, 10 meters onto one of those poofy things that firefighters catch people jumping out burning
big
buildings.
So yeah, he falls onto an inflated crash bag and survives.
But it doesn't work when you jump from the 138th floor, but it does work if you fall about 10 meters, 20
But
meters
it was done very well, because we had no idea how far he was up when
really
he let go.
Was.
And then said it was like, okay, cool.
That was great. That was so great.
That whole elevator.
Like, oh, never mind.
Only had one casualty, and that was when it originally stopped.
Yeah.
So that was done pretty well.
So the kids and the women that were in there are saved. The fireman is probably slightly shaken, but still alive. And obviously, well, obviously, Steve McQueen is absolutely fine. Because it's Steve McQueen.
Yeah, I think we knew Steve McQueen and Paul Newman were going to survive this.
Yeah, despite the tendency in these films to kill off lots of main stars, it seemed unlikely that either of those two would be among the dead.
Yeah, I think we could be confident about those two.
Yeah.
So we've had the ending from one of the two books this is based on, and that's The Breacher's Boy. But we haven't yet had the other ending of the other book that this was based on.
Right, because yes, The Breacher's Boy is being used, but it's very slow, and it's going to take a lot longer to evacuate than the room has.
Wow, yeah,
the room is going to be up in flames in 15 minutes. I think they determined.
Yeah, O'Halloran gets back to the control room and is told there's 15 minutes before the fire breaches that room.
Yeah.
And there's no way they're going to get everybody out, because they're pretty much, they've cleared the women out, but there's still a lot of men there.
Yeah, a lot, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but this bit is, they start trying to evacuate the men, and at that point, Doucheface, son-in-law, with a couple of his cronies, I can only assume, possibly the mayor and the senator, I really wasn't paying attention to who
they
were.
No, they weren't the mayor and the senator.
They were, okay.
They try and move their way forward, but...
Yeah, they basically go, the women and the children have gone already, so we're next, tear up their numbers.
And then Duncan punches him in the stomach and says, you wait your turn.
Yeah, in fact, you're going
good.
Last.
And we all cheer.
And I'm going
last. He said Duncan was going last, but...
Yeah.
So yes, they're trying to move people out, but blatantly they're going to run out of time before everybody's out. So they come up with the only plan left, which is to explode the building's water tanks on the roof. Apparently these tanks hold 1 million gallons of water, and blowing the tanks is their last hope of extinguishing the fire. Obviously this option, there's a fairly good chance it will kill everybody in the promenade room, as several billion, well, 1 million gallons of water come rushing through. But it's, you know, it's the only chance they've got.
Which is the ending from the other book.
So, as O'Halloran is explaining the plan to Roberts on the phone, and then Roberts is explaining it to the trapped guests, the fire at that point reaches the promenade room. Simmons, now drunk and panicking, leads a pack of followers in a takeover of the Breacher's Boy. So it's at this point he decides he's going to go for it.
Yeah.
He gets in, but Senator Parker attempts to drag him out and restore order. However, the weight of Parker, Simmons, and several other men carries the Breacher's Boy out of the window. Simmons then pushes the senator and several other men hanging off the Breacher's Boy to their death 135 floors below, because he's such a nice person.
Three of them were hanging on, and he just kicks them all off.
Yeah. However, Simmons' victory is very short-lived, as the rope to the boy parts, and Simmons also Yay! Falls to his death.
Oh no, what a shame. It couldn't have happened to a nicer person.
My notes simply say, hooray.
We did actually cheer when he died.
Yeah, we did.
That.
Me too.
We had a little cheer when he nearly died earlier, but when he died this time around, we did cheer. Yep. So.
I know it's really bad of us for celebrating someone dying in a fire when, you know, that happens in reality. But considering how
he's not real, though. We're celebrating his fictional evil person.
Yeah, the actor is fine. And, you know, the character was a dick. So, whatever.
He was fictional. He was selfish. And he was possibly the original cause, even if he wasn't solely responsible.
Yeah. So, so he's fallen to his death. While this is all going on, O'Halloran is helicoptered to the roof of the burning tower.
I love this bit when it's like, oh, there's only two people that can possibly do this setting of the explosives, and one of them's like injured. So obviously it's you, Steve McQueen. I mean, Fire Chief, dude. It's like
even though you've been hanging off a blooming elevator and are absolutely exhausted, and you're sort of been sitting there looking like death warmed up. It's all down to you, Steve McQueen. Yep.
You haven't had enough lines yet. You haven't quite matched Paul Newman's number of lines, so it's going to be you. Yeah.
So they helicopter him to the roof. He makes his way down to the floor with tanks in it, while Doug Roberts makes his way up to the floor where the tanks are.
I love the spacesuit that he was in. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, a standard fire suit, yeah. And they make their way sort of around and stick C4 explosives.
He gets like the fastest crash course on how to set explosives there's ever been. But it's fine. He's got this because he's Paul Newman.
Yeah, it's all good. Yeah. He's Paul Newman. He'll do it.
It is just to like put it into the gaps like you would with BluTech. Stick the two bits of metal in, feed the wire back, and then just add it to the charger.
Yeah, I'm hoping it really is that straightforward.
Yeah. Well,
having never used
I don't think
C4
we're ever
going
to get a chance to play with C4, so let's not worry about it.
I'm cool with that.
But considering that there was only one person who could possibly do this, then he trained someone else to do it really very quickly.
Well, I wasn't sure if he was the only person to do the explosives or the only person who could use the sort of high-temperature fire suit. But
I think he was the only one that was qualified to supervise the explosives.
Yeah, I think it was the explosives.
The best part was when he rang up Paul Newman and was like, I need you to meet me. We need to blow up the tanks. And Paul Newman was like, well, which idiot have they gone to do this? And he was like, oh, I'm sure they'll find someone. I need you to meet me in that room.
Yeah.
Right. And he immediately knew that they were pretty much both going on a suicide mission.
Yeah, so they work the way around Chief O'Halloran sticking our explosives on the tanks, where Doug Roberts goes around and sticks all of the explosives on the floors, because obviously it's one thing to blow the tanks up, but you also have to blow the floor below it to make sure that the water goes down and not outwards.
Yeah.
So they set the charges, they set the timer for 5 minutes, and they make their way back to the promenade room.
Quickly. Very quickly.
Securing themselves with... screwing themselves to anything that's bolted down, really.
There's a lot of rope in this room. Like, there's a lot of people tying themselves up with a lot of rope. And I was thinking, where's all this rope actually come from? I haven't seen anyone carrying lots of rope in there at any point, and it's not something you'd have lying around at a party.
Well, maybe it is the 70s, Daisy. We don't know what was going to happen at the party later on.
There was a lot of rope. It was attached
I know the firefighters brought rope with them, but then they also had the rope from the breacher's boy. Yeah. They had the rope from the breacher's boy that had collapsed. And also they said they were using things like tablecloths and things like that.
There'll be like probably curtain, you know, those... Yeah. Things that you put around curtains so that
this was just one of those moments where I queried it and then I had to go, let's just assume there was rope, Daisy. We didn't see it arriving, but that must have arrived, some kind of rope Amazon drone delivery, you know.
So they start, they join the rest of the people trapped in the promenade room and secure themselves to whatever they can before the explosion and the ensuing flood.
Can I just ask a question here?
Hello.
When, I think it was the architect, tied himself to a pillar and sat down, the fire person opposite him, that was a woman, right? Was that a woman of colour?
No, that was a gentleman.
Okay. Well,
he had sideburns, didn't he?
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was a woman.
I know, some women have sideburns.
Because he was actually in the opening scene when... Well, the opening scene of the fire engines going to the fire, he was one of the ones talking there, and he was definitely a he, yeah. Unfortunately.
Oh, is he the one that said, yeah, I fought a fire at a high rise before? It was like a chimney.
Yeah. Mm. So, yes, they've tied themselves to banisters and to columns and anything else. And suddenly the fire starts making its way through the room a lot more aggressively. So a number of unnamed, unknown partygoers have to untie themselves and run to the other side of the room. guess which ones aren't going to make it.
They are going to be a dead. Yay! More casualties.
And so, yes, the explosives finally go off and the tank explodes and the roof gives way. And then, like a dump tank, lots and lots of water just rushes through the building.
And it's like magic, because even though it goes straight either out the windows or down the stairwells, it magically manages to put the fire out on all the different floors where there is fire.
Yeah, and I did notice the floors. Yeah. I did notice that the fires went out almost as if someone was turning a valve on a gas.
Yeah, they did, didn't they? A bit like it was actually a miniature being filmed. And,
yeah. So, yes, the water floods everywhere. There are people who are basically washed away and washed through the glass and again down to their deaths. They did say when they discussed the plan that they didn't think everybody would make it. But thankfully, Steve McQueen and Paul Newman and Fred Astaire did indeed make it.
Mm.
What happened to the Duncan guy? I know I saw him as the mayor was swept away. I saw him stand up and go, oh, no, not the mayor. But I don't know if he survived or not.
Which Duncan guy? Which one was Duncan?
Oh, no, he did. The dad. Because we saw him then later on with
his... Oh, yeah, because he then commiserates his daughter on...
Yeah, so he survived, but the mayor... I don't think the mayor did. So the fire is magically put out and somehow they're suddenly able to make their way down through the building, despite most of the stairwells being completely blown and there being no power and no lifts.
It's okay, they used magic. It's all fine.
They kind of brushed over that bit. Yeah. So they all make it safely down onto the ground. Harley is informed that Lizalette didn't make it down in the elevator.
But oh wait, here's her cat. This will make
well,
everything
better. Well, yes, in grieving disbelief, he impotently yells out her name, which is overheard by Jerrigan, who is O.J. Simpson, who finds him and gives him Lizalette's cat, Elkie.
You lost your woman, but you got a cat. So, you know.
So he holds the cat and tears up in grief and shame.
Yeah, there was a lot of kind of reunions and non-reunions here, which was really it was a very bittersweet scene, because it was really nice seeing people like, oh my god, I thought I'd lost you, and yes, I found you, and other people, where is such and such, oh no, they died. So that's
you had the scene where O'Halloran walks out from the base of the building and turns and sees the sort of the covered bodies of the dead fire people as well.
Yeah,
so.
that was heartbreaking.
Would you like to know the body count, on screen body count there?
Yes.
Well, let's just get to the end, because we've only got a couple of lines left. So, because no one else dies at this point, but, you know, we should wrap the story up before we... So reunited with Susan, Doug feels that the glass tower should be left shut down as a shrine to all the... well, the word they use in the film, despite the film being a PG, is not going to be used in this podcast.
Wow.
So, a shrine to all of the bull beep in the world.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
He also accepts O'Halloran's bitter comment about architects and the need for them to consult with the fire department on how to build skyscrapers.
That are, you know, better...
Fire safe,
yes. Yes, fire safe.
Yeah, and Doug Roberts says he's going to, so I think they're going to be better.
Well, yeah, because it's like when are architects, and it's like, dude's like, turns around and said, is now a good time, basically?
Yeah, I'd be surprised if he designs another skyscraper ever again, to be honest. But
no.
I'd like to think that they're besties now.
Yay, me
so
too.
Wearied and soiled, yet somehow dry despite the vast amount of water just dumped on him, Steve McQueen gets into his car and drives off, which I thought was very reminiscent to the scene that echoes sort of the end of Airport as well, where they got into the car and drive off.
Mm. Yeah.
And I noted then that really wasn't a man who should be driving at that point, because he hadn't slept in God knows how long.
This person has been through some stuff. Why?
But it's Steve McQueen, and Steve McQueen is a man, so he can drive under any circumstances. Or something.
Man.
And that is the end of the film.
Yay!
So yes, shall we have the body count then, Daisy?
The in-film body count that they mentioned was, less than 200 died, so really we were lucky. The actual on-screen body count that we saw, which is how we count body count, was 41 flaming deaths. So, well, not
which
all,
was
not all flaming.
Fairly low.
Yeah, but a lot higher than Airport.
Which was one, that wasn't was, it, if memory
yes,
serves?
That was one. Yes. A very disappointing one.
I was surprised, so. But okay with that, because I'm happy when people don't die, Daisy.
Yes, me too.
This is a disaster movie. They're meant to die.
Not necessarily, you know, destruction of property and some injuries maybe, lost limbs, but it's okay if people don't die, that's a good thing.
We have a different attitude towards disaster movies. I think I'm more the target audience on them then.
Well, it wasn't a bad film. I didn't think it was a bad film. I thought it was possibly a bit too long, but aside from the beginning bits, I wasn't quite sure what else it could have been cut out.
No. I was quite interested as well. Apparently the music was another one by John Williams, which surprised me because it didn't really sound like John Williams' normal stuff. I thought it sounded more like James Horner than John Williams, but that's, you know.
That opening shot with the where we were following the helicopter across San Francisco was intended to be unscored. And John Williams was like, no, I can write you something for going over this. And it was like, whatever. And so he did and went, no, that's good. Let's use that. Such is the majesty of John Williams.
So, that is Towering Inferno.
Yay!
Obviously a film that still resonates today with the fact that some lessons just aren't necessarily learnt. But let's get some final thoughts. Daisy, your final thoughts, because I know you hate this sort of film.
Oh my god, this was great. We had flaming deaths all the way through. It was, we had the fire starting from really early on. So we had like, yes, we are straight in there to the disaster that just kept growing and growing and growing. It was edge of the seat stuff, proper peril all the way through because we were getting big name stars actually dying. I can't ask for more from a disaster movie. And considering this was coming from two different novels smashed together, I thought it made actually a pretty coherent story.
Not wanting to dampen your fire, no pun intended there, Daisy, but they didn't actually die. They are just actors. They were fine.
Oh, no, I'm so disappointed.
Yeah, sorry about that. Sammy, your final thoughts?
My final thoughts are I don't think I'm the target audience for a disaster movie. I'm an anxious individual, and while there are movies that I find palpably stressful and yet enjoy watching, like Cube, for instance, they're usually somewhat more removed from my actual lived experience. This just makes me scared to go into large buildings, and that's not something I enjoy. I spent a lot of this movie going, oh my god, that could happen to my house, and trying not to cry. Well-executed film with an excellent cast and a very good score and yada, 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 and windows that were much too breakable for, you know, like, an exterior of a building. But I am quite content to never, ever watch it again.
Fair enough. And Joe, your final thoughts?
Again, not sure I'm the target audience. I mean, I already don't like lifts. This movie didn't really cement any love for lifts. I mean, it was a perfectly cromulent movie. I did like the fact that Steve McQueen in it, even though I got him and Paul Newman mixed up.
Honestly.
But as Sammy said, I would not watch it again. Sorry, Taze.
No, I'm for me personally, I might watch it again, but not in any time soon and not in any rush. As I said earlier, I think it's a good film. I don't think I could say, honestly, that I enjoyed watching it. It was, I don't know, there was something about it that I just didn't like. But it obviously was very popular at its time. It made more money than any other film of its year.
Can you imagine seeing this in the cinema as well? Like, wow!
Yeah.
And again, this was the time of the disaster movie, because you'd had Airport, you'd had the Poseidon Adventure, you'd got this, you got Airport 75 coming up soon, so yeah. But no, it's a genre that has pretty much had its day.
I don't think it's had its day. Like Geostorm earlier this year, come on.
Well, did anybody watch that though?
Well, I really wanted to go see it, but no one wanted to go with me, so I'll be getting it on DVD.
All right.
Disaster movies are still big business. Come on, like San Andreas and all that, they're still going strong.
I'm not sure big business is the right word, but they are still being made. But no, not for me. So yes, that was Towering Inferno, 1974's top grossing movie. Next time round, we will be back with a slightly different film in the form of Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window, the first Alfred Hitchcock film we cover in this podcast, but by no means the last.
Spoilers, it's good.
I don't think I've seen it all the way through, so that should be interesting.
Ooh. When you watch it, keep an eye out for the Alfred Hitchcock cameo, of course.
We will point it out when we come back to it. But yes, that is in the next episode of Home Movie Club. But for now, I'd like to thank you all for listening. I'd like to thank my fellow podcasters. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Daisy.
Thank you.
And thank you, Sammy.
Thank you very much.
And again, thank you all for listening. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Home Movie Club, part of the That Podcast Thing Network. Visit us at www.thatpodcastthing.co.uk, where you can find links to all our social media, including Twitter, Facebook, and our new YouTube channel. Please like and subscribe for news of our future episodes coming soon.